Nemoto presents scientific giants. Thomas Hunt Morgan, The Fly Room and the Chromosome Map. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 12 minutes. You're listening to Scientific Giants Who Changed the World. Each episode stands beside one mind and follows a thread of curiosity until it ties to the world we inhabit. Today we step into a room that was small, hot, crowded, and famously chaotic. A room that smelled of fermenting bananas and hummed with the wings of fruit flies. It was not a cathedral of science. It was a workshop. And inside that workshop, heredity stopped being an abstract idea and became a map you could draw. The man at the center of that transformation was Thomas Hunt Morgan, and the place was known simply as the Fly Room. Morgan was born in 1866 in Lexington, Kentucky, into a world still shaped by the aftermath of the American Civil War. He grew up in a country rebuilding and redefining itself, but his imagination was pulled not toward politics so much as toward living forms. Like many naturalists of his era, he began with observation. He studied animals. He studied embryos. He studied the strange fact that life repeats itself while also producing difference. He trained as a biologist at a time when biology was not yet unified. It was a collection of subfields: anatomy, embryology, natural history. Genetics, as a coherent discipline, had not yet arrived. One of the most interesting things about Morgan is that he did not begin as a believer in Mendel. When Mendel's work was rediscovered around 1900, it sparked both excitement and argument. Some scientists embraced the idea of particulate inheritance immediately. Others resisted. Morgan was among the skeptical. He worried that Mendelian factors were too neat, too simplistic for the fluid complexity of development. He was an embryologist at heart, and embryology teaches you that life is not just a set of discrete traits. It is a process of unfolding, timing, gradients, and interaction. Morgan suspected that the gene idea might be a conceptual shortcut that ignored the deeper mechanics of how traits emerge. That skepticism, however, is part of what made him powerful. He did not convert because of fashion. He converted because the evidence cornered him. By the time Morgan took a position at Columbia University, he was ready to test heredity with a rigor that would either break Mendelian genetics or force it to mature. He needed an organism suited to experiments that could be repeated quickly, with large numbers, under controlled conditions. He chose Drosophila melanogaster, the common fruit fly. To modern ears, that choice sounds obvious because Drosophila became a classic genetic model. But it wasn't obvious then. It was a gamble that a small insect could reveal universal laws. Fruit flies were ideal for reasons that seem almost designed for genetics. They have short generation times, about 2 weeks. They produce many offspring. They are easy to keep in bottles. And perhaps most importantly, they have visible traits that can mutate in ways the human eye can see: eye color, wing shape, body color. If heredity is truly particulate, then with enough crosses and enough counting, patterns should emerge as clearly as Mendel's peas. Morgan gathered students and collaborators, Alfred Sturtevant, Calvin Bridges, Hermann Muller, and others, and they worked in conditions that were almost comically unglamorous. The fly room was small. There were shelves of bottles. There were flies everywhere. People joked that the flies escaped into the building. The work required attention to tiny differences, quick hands, and constant vigilance. It was intense, repetitive, and oddly intimate. They would anesthetize flies with ether, sort them, identify mutations under microscopes, set up crosses, and then wait for offspring to develop. Then they would count again. And again. At first, Morgan's lab looked for mutations. Unexpected traits that appeared spontaneously. These mutations were gold because they were nature's own experiments. They created new differences that could be tracked through inheritance. One famous mutation they found involved eye color. Most fruit flies have red eyes. But one day, a male fly appeared with white eyes. It was a tiny change easily dismissed as a curiosity. In Morgan's hands, it became a lever that moved biology. Morgan crossed the white-eyed male with red-eyed females and observed the offspring. The first generation had red eyes. So far, so Mendelian, perhaps red is dominant and white is recessive. But the next generation produced a strange pattern. The white eyes reappeared, and they appeared almost exclusively in males. This was not a minor detail. It was a clue. It suggested that the inheritance of this trait was connected to sex. Morgan realized that the trait was likely carried on a sex chromosome, specifically the X chromosome. In many animals, including humans and fruit flies, females are XX and males are XY. If a gene for eye color sits on the X chromosome, then its inheritance will follow a pattern tied to the distribution of X chromosomes between sexes. A male having only one X will express whatever allele he carries there, dominant or recessive, because there is no second copy to mask it. This insight was a turning point. It provided strong evidence that genes are located on chromosomes. The chromosome theory of inheritance had been proposed by others, and cytologists had observed chromosomes during cell division. But Morgan's experiments connected those visible structures to the rules of heredity in a way that was hard to deny. Heredity was no longer an invisible set of factors floating in the organism. It was anchored to physical structures inside cells. But Morgan and his students did not stop at anchoring genes to chromosomes. They began to ask, if genes are on chromosomes, can we determine their arrangement? Can we map them? The key observation was that some traits seem to be inherited together more often than Mendel's law of independent assortment would predict. Mendel's law holds when genes are on different chromosomes, or far apart on the same chromosome, so that during meiosis, they assort independently. But if genes are close together on the same chromosome, they tend to travel as a package. This is called linkage. Linkage created a new kind of problem. If genes are linked, then how do we ever get new combinations of traits? The answer lay in recombination, also called crossing over. During the formation of eggs and sperm, chromosomes can exchange segments, breaking and rejoining. This process can separate linked genes. And crucially, the likelihood of a crossover between two genes depends on how far apart they are. Genes close together are rarely separated. Genes far apart are separated more often. This turned recombination frequency into a measuring tool. If you could determine how often two traits recombined in offspring, you could infer the relative distance between the genes responsible. The chromosome became not just a carrier but a line segment along which genes could be ordered. One of Morgan's students, Alfred Sturtevant, famously had the idea to build the first genetic map. The story goes that he was still an undergraduate when he realized the logic. Recombination frequencies could be translated into distances. He went home and, in an evening, sketched the first gene map based on the lab's data. Whether it happened exactly in one night or over longer work, the conceptual leap was real. It took heredity from ratios to geography. The fly room became, in effect, a cartography studio for the genome. They mapped genes on chromosomes. They showed that the genome is not an abstract list of traits. It has structure. Genes have order. And that order matters. Morgan's lab also uncovered deeper complexities. They observed nondisjunction events, cases where chromosomes fail to separate properly during meiosis, producing offspring with unusual chromosome numbers. These events, studied by Calvin Bridges, provided even stronger evidence for the chromosome theory, because the abnormal inheritance patterns matched the abnormal chromosome distributions. In other words, the behavior of traits could be predicted by the behavior of chromosomes under a microscope. The physical and the genetic were locked together. This was a profound moment in biology. Mendel had shown that inheritance follows mathematical rules. Morgan showed where those rules live. He turned heredity into something with an address. And yet, even in the midst of these triumphs, we should keep Morgan human. He was not a solitary genius who simply announced a truth. He was the leader of a collective. The fly room's achievements were built from countless hours of sorting flies, recording counts, debating interpretations, and designing crosses. Morgan's genius included his ability to build and sustain an environment where that work could happen and where young scientists could make real intellectual contributions. His name became the banner, but the banner covered a community. Morgan eventually moved to Caltech and helped shape American genetics as an institution. He received the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1933 for his discoveries concerning the role of chromosomes in heredity. By then, genetics had become a discipline with its own language and tools, and Morgan's work was central to that transformation. The world that followed Morgan was a world in which genes could be treated as units, located, recombined, and eventually, in the later 20th century, sequenced and edited. Modern genetics, genomics, and biotechnology trace a line back to that cramped room and its bottles of flies. If Mendel planted the conceptual seed, Morgan cultivated the field into a workable science. So how should we remember Thomas Hunt Morgan? We should remember him as the man who turned heredity into a map. He began as a skeptic, which is to say he began with a demand that the theory survive contact with reality. He accepted Mendel not because he wanted a neat story, but because experiments forced him to accept the particulate nature of inheritance. Then he did what great scientists do. He didn't just accept a theory, he expanded it, anchored it, and made it operational. We should also remember the fly room itself as a model of scientific creation. The great discoveries are not always born in marble halls. Sometimes they are born in messy rooms where the work is repetitive and unglamorous, and where the real currency is attention. The fly room was a factory of evidence. It produced a new way of seeing life. If you want a final image, picture a student leaning over a microscope, counting tiny flies and noting a pattern that doesn't fit expectation. Picture Morgan behind him, not supplying answers but demanding that the pattern be tested until it either dissolves or becomes law. Picture chromosomes under a microscope during cell division, and then picture the inheritance of eye color and wing shape matching that chromosome behavior as if the organism is confessing the location of its own secrets. You've been listening to Scientific Giants Who Changed the World. Today we followed Thomas Hunt Morgan from skepticism to evidence, from fruit fly mutations to the chromosome map, from heredity as a concept to heredity as a physical address. In our next episode we will meet Barbara McClintock, who stared at corn plants long enough to discover that genes do not always stay put, that the genome can move, jump, and rearrange itself, forcing biology to accept a deeper kind of dynamism. Until then, thank you for your attention and your time. This episode was written as a continuous story for the ear, because Morgan's legacy is not a list of experiments. It is a change in how we imagine inheritance itself, no longer as a vague family resemblance, but as a structured landscape you can explore, measure, and eventually transform.